Okay, let's unpack this. Have you ever really stopped to consider the sheer elegance behind something as simple as taking a breath or maybe just moving your hand, or how a tiny pinch of salt can be absolutely vital for your life, while, pure sodium can be explosively dangerous? It's easy to just be, to live in these incredible bodies, but beneath that kind of effortless existence lies this unseen universe of chemical reactions. Today, we're plunging right into that universe. We're going to explore the fundamental chemistry that forms the very building blocks of life itself, from the, well, inconceivably small atoms to the grand macromolecules that quite literally make up you.
Yeah, and what's truly fascinating here is how Dr. Hoffman, across his lectures, meticulously demonstrates that the same foundational rules governing atoms and molecules in, say, a test tube, they're the identical rules orchestrating life within every single one of your cells. It's all just chemistry, really elegantly woven into the fabric of who you are.
Exactly. So our mission today is to distill the essential, maybe mind-bending insights from Dr. Hoffman's work on atoms, chemical bonds, and the four major categories of biological macromolecules. We'll reveal their critical roles, highlight some surprising connections to your daily existence, and hopefully give you a real shortcut to being genuinely well-informed about the chemistry of you. So to begin this journey, we have to grasp the unbelievably tiny. Dr. Hoffman really hammers home that atoms are the universal building blocks of all material things. And when we say tiny, we mean like beyond our everyday comprehension. Think about this. Your body contains approximately 100 trillion cells. That's already a huge number. And Dr. Hoffman notes that even a single invisibly small cell, one you can't even see, is packed with billions of atoms. They are truly that fundamental and, well, that numerous.
It's incredible to think about, isn't it? And as minuscule as atoms are, they're actually composed of even smaller subatomic particles. We generally focus on three main players. You've got protons, which carry a positive charge, plus one, and, crucially, define the atom's identity there in the nucleus. Then neutrons, which are neutral, zero charge, also in the nucleus. Adding mass, they're almost identical in size to protons. And finally, electrons. These tiny, negatively charged Menicon particles zip around in the space outside the nucleus. They're much, much smaller. It's the unique combination and sort of arrangement of these three that dictates pretty much everything about a substance, you know, from its color to its reactivity.
Right. And Dr. Hoffman also touches on how we visualize these atoms. You've probably seen that classic planetary model, right, where electrons orbit a nucleus like planets around a sun. It's a nice, simple visual. But Dr. Hoffman explains that the more accurate, though much harder to picture, model is the cloud of probability, or orbital model. It's less about neat orbits and more about electrons existing as this kind of diffuse cloud, a probability of where they might be at any given moment, which, if you think about it, is a pretty wild concept for something so foundational.
Indeed it is. And it's that proton count we mentioned that is the true fingerprint of an element. Dr. Hoffman stresses this point. An element is a substance made of only one type of atom. So if an atom has, say, six protons, it is, without exception, carbon, always. Change that proton number and you've completely changed the element.
Okay, but atoms of the same element aren't always identical copies of each other, are they? Dr. Hoffman clarifies this with isotopes. He explains that different versions of the same element exist, called isotopes. These variations simply differ in their number of neutrons. The proton count stays the same. For instance, common hydrogen has one proton, no neutrons. But there's also deuterium, heavy hydrogen, with one proton and one neutron. And Dr. Hoffman points out these seemingly minor differences are actually critical in fields like medicine, where isotopes are used as tracers in medical imaging, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. And beyond isotopes, we also have ions. This is where things get interesting with charges. An ion is just an atom that has gained or lost electrons, giving it an overall electrical charge. Lose electrons and you become positively charged, that's a cation. Gain electrons, you become negatively charged, an anion. What's crucial, as Dr. Hoffman states, is that in normal chemical reactions, the proton count in the nucleus always remains constant. It's those outer electrons that are, you know, swapping partners or getting transferred. Which sort of raises an important question. Why do atoms even bother gaining or losing electrons at all?
Ah, that's where things get really fascinating. Dr. Hoffman makes it abundantly clear that chemical reactions are fundamentally about the rearrangement of these electrons. The atomic nuclei, those dense cores with protons and neutrons, they essentially just sit tight during a reaction. So all those profound transformations we see in chemistry like that, highly reactive sodium turning into harmless salt, are just different electron dance parties, basically leading to dramatically altered properties.
Exactly. Dr. Hoffman uses such a vivid example. Sodium, right, a dangerously reactive metal that fizzes violently in water, and chlorine, a poisonous gas. Neither is something you want around in its pure form. Yet when they react through this clever rearrangement of their electrons, they form sodium chloride, just everyday table salt. And Dr. Hoffman underscores that no matter is created or destroyed here, only electrons are reshuffled, and suddenly you have something not just harmless, but absolutely essential for life. It's a real testament to the power of these electron rearrangements.
So what drives these electron reshuffles then? Why do they do it?
Well, Dr. Hoffman beautifully explains that atoms desire stability. It's like they want to be content. They achieve this stability when their outermost electron shell, their valence shell, is full. He points to the noble gases like helium or neon in those glowing signs as perfect examples. They're inherently stable because their outer shells are already completely full. That makes them inert and unreactive. They're essentially the chemical world's perfectly happy introverts, you could say.
Huh. I like that. Okay, so they're stable already. But what about the others?
Right. And that desire for a full outer shell is precisely why other elements form chemical bonds. They team up to get stable.
Yeah.
Dr. Hoffman introduces valence here. It's a property indicating how many bonds an atom typically needs to form to achieve this stability. Hydrogen, for instance, has a valence of 1, needs 1 bond. Oxygen has a valence of 2, needs 2. And carbon, uniquely, has a valence of 4. Dr. Hoffman calls this tetravalence, meaning it can form 4 bonds. This tetravalence is what makes carbon the incredibly versatile backbone of all organic molecules and therefore all life. It's super important.
Okay, so this want for stability drives the bonds. And Dr. Hoffman talks about 2 major types, right?
That's right. First, there are ionic bonds. These are all about the transfer of electrons, completely giving one away. Picture a metal atom, maybe a bit electron rich, essentially handing over an electron to a non-metal, which is often a bit electron hungry. This creates oppositely charged ions, a cation and an anion, that then powerfully attract each other, like tiny magnets forming the bond. Our table salt example, sodium chloride, is a classic ionic bond.
Okay, so transfer makes ions, ions attract. Got it. What's the other type?
The second major type are covalent bonds. Here, instead of a transfer, atoms share valence electrons. It's more of a partnership. This usually happens between 2 nonmetals. You can have a single covalent bond where 2 electrons are shared, or even a double bond where 4 electrons are shared. These shared bonds are generally much stronger than ionic bonds, especially in biological systems. This sharing creates highly stable molecules that are fundamental to life.
And even within covalent bonds, Dr. Hoffman makes another distinction, doesn't he, between polar and nonpolar?
Yes, exactly. This distinction hinges on a concept called electronegativity, which is basically an atom's greediness for shared electrons. How strongly does it pull? In a nonpolar bond, like in an oxygen molecule, O2, or carbon dioxide, CO2, because it's symmetrical, the electrons are shared pretty much equally between the atoms. No one's hogging them.
Okay, fair sharing.
But in a polar covalent bond, like in water, H2O, the sharing is unequal. Oxygen, for example, is far more electronegative, much greedier than hydrogen. So the shared electrons spend more time buzzing around the oxygen atom. This creates a slight negative charge on the oxygen end and slight positive charges on the hydrogen ends of the molecule. It's not a full charge like an ion, but a partial charge.
And this polarity in water, Dr. Hoffman makes a really strong point about this, right? Something like life wouldn't exist without it.
He absolutely does. He says quite directly, none of us would exist. No organisms would ever exist if it weren't for this fact. He's referring specifically to water's unique, life-sustaining properties, which all stem from that polarity we just discussed. It's that important.
Wow. Okay, so what does this polarity lead to?
Well, a huge consequence is hydrogen bonds. Now, these aren't the strong covalent bonds within a water molecule. They're weaker attractions between different water molecules. That partially positive hydrogen on one water molecule is attracted to the partially negative oxygen on a nearby water molecule. Because of this attraction, water molecules tend to stick together.
Like little magnets clinging to each other?
Kind of, yeah. Like a molecular Velcro, maybe, constantly forming and breaking. It's a weaker bond, but there are so many of them in liquid water, they have huge effects.
Okay, so what are some of those effects? Dr. Hoffman gives examples, right?
He does. Great examples. Surface tension, for one. That invisible skin on water that lets insects walk on it or makes a droplet hold its shape. That's hydrogen bonds pulling the surface molecules closer together. Another critical property is water's role as an excellent solvent. Because water molecules are polar, they can effectively surround and separate individual ions from substances like salts or other polar molecules, essentially dissolving them.
Ah, so that's why salt dissolves so easily. The water molecules just pull the sodium and chloride ions apart because of their own partial charges.
Precisely. Water's polarity is key to its ability to dissolve so many things, which is vital for transporting nutrients and waste in living systems.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, related to water and ions, Dr. Hoffman talks about the pH scale, right? What's the deal with that?
Right, the pH scale. It's a way to measure how acidic or basic, also called alkaline, a solution is. Now, the key thing Dr. Hoffman points out is that it's a logarithmic scale, not linear. Each whole number step represents a tenfold change in concentration. The H in pH actually stands for hydrogen ions, H+, and the scale tracks their concentration.
Tenfold. So, like, pH 6 is 10 times more acidic than pH 7, and pH 5 is 100 times more acidic.
Exactly. Lower pH means higher acidity, which means a greater concentration of those hydrogen ions. pH 7 is neutral, like pure water.
And what makes something an acid or a base, basically?
Dr. Hoffman simplifies it nicely. An acid is typically a hydrogen-containing compound that releases hydrogen ions when you dissolve it in water. Think lemon juice or vinegar. A base, on the other hand, is a substance that removes hydrogen ions from the solution, often by releasing hydroxide ions, which combine with H+ affinity. Think baking soda or ammonia.
Okay. And why is this so important for life?
Well, Dr. Hoffman stresses that maintaining an incredibly stable, incredibly tight pH range, a process called homeostasis, is absolutely vital for most cells in your body. Even slight deviations from the normal pH range, which is usually very close to neutral for most body fluids, can be lethal. Proteins can change shape, enzymes stop working. It's serious stuff.
Except for the stomach, right? You mentioned that.
Right. The stomach is a notable exception with its very low pH, like 1 or 2, which is perfect for killing bacteria you might ingest and helping digest proteins. But most other parts of you need that steady, near-neutral pH.
And you had that really cool example about holding your breath.
Oh, yeah, that's a powerful one. When you feel that overwhelming, unavoidable urge to inhale after holding your breath, it's not actually because you've run out of oxygen. You probably still have plenty. Instead, it's the buildup of carbon dioxide, CO2, in your blood. When CO2 mixes with water in your blood, it forms carbonic acid, and this acid lowers your blood's pH, making it slightly more acidic.
And your brain detects that tiny pH change.
Your brain stem, specifically, is incredibly sensitive to even that tiny drop in blood pH. That slight change is the trigger. It forces you to breathe, overriding your conscious will, just to blow off that excess CO2 and bring your blood pH right back to its normal happy level.
Wow. So what this all means for your everyday life is, well, it's literally a matter of life and death, dictated by tiny molecular changes in acidity.
Absolutely. It really highlights how critical this chemical balance is.
Yeah.
So, okay, we've talked about atoms, bonds, water, pH, the small stuff. But how do these tiny interactions build the incredible complexity we see in living things? That's where the big molecules come in. Dr. Hoffman transitions here to the larger, complex molecules that make up all living organisms. He introduces them as organic compounds because they are carbon-based, usually also containing hydrogen, oxygen, and sometimes nitrogen or phosphorus. And the really big ones, the huge chains, are called macromolecules. Dr. Hoffman emphasizes that all living things, from the smallest bacterium to you listening right now, are built from these organic macromolecules.
Right. And cells have basically two fundamental ways to manage these big molecules, right? Building them up and breaking them down.
Exactly. Two key reaction types. First, there's dehydration synthesis. Think making something by removing water. It's how smaller single units, called monomers, link together chemically to form larger chains, or polymers. And in the process of forming that link, a molecule of water, H2O, is removed. Build bigger, lose water.
Okay. Dehydration synthesis builds polymers. What's the opposite?
The reverse process is hydrolysis, which literally means water splitting, hydrolysis. Here, a larger polymer molecule is broken down into a smaller monomer units. And how does it do that? By adding a molecule of water across the bond, which effectively splits it. Break down, add water.
And Dr. Hoffman used digestion as an example of hydrolysis, didn't he?
Yes, a perfect, relatable example. When you eat, say, a potato full of starch, which is a big polymer, those large molecules are too big to be absorbed by your cells directly. So your digestive system uses hydrolysis reactions, adding water to break down that large starch polymer into smaller glucose monomer units.
Which can be absorbed.
Exactly. Once absorbed, your body then uses those glucose monomers or amino acids from protein or whatever and uses dehydration synthesis to reassemble them into your own specific macromolecules, the unique glycogen stores or proteins your body needs. It's this constant vital cycle of breaking down food and building yourself up.
Okay, so it's all about monomers and polymers, hydrolysis and dehydration. And these complex organic macromolecules fall into four major categories that Dr. Hoffman identifies as vital for all organisms.
That's right, the big four. Polysaccharides, which are carbohydrates, lipids, proteins, and nucleic acids.
Let's start with polysaccharides then, complex carbs.
Okay. Dr. Hoffman explains these are polymers built from smaller units called monosaccharides, which are simple sugars. He highlights glucose as the single most important universal fuel source for pretty much all cells. From the simplest single-celled organism to every cell in your body, it's the primary energy currency, you could say.
And besides fuel, they're used for storage too, right? Like plants storing starch.
Precisely. Plants store their excess glucose as starch. We animals do something similar, storing excess glucose as glycogen. Dr. Hoffman notes that glycogen is primarily stored in your liver and muscles. The liver glycogen, especially, plays a critical role in regulating your blood glucose levels, storing glucose when levels are high after a meal, and releasing it when they dip too low between meals, keeping your body's energy supply steady.
Okay, carbs for fuel and storage. What's next? Lipids.
Next up are lipids. Dr. Hoffman makes an important distinction here. While they are definitely macromolecules, they are not technically polymers built from repeating identical monomers like the others. And they're generally not quite as enormous in size either. But their importance is absolutely immense.
Okay, so not true polymers. What kind of lipids does he talk about? Fats?
Yes, fats are a major type. Chemically, they're composed of a glycerol molecule attached to three fatty acids, hence triglycerides, which you might hear about. He emphasizes their crucial role in long-term energy storage. Why? Because they have a remarkably high energy density. Gram for gram, fat stores way more energy than carbohydrates.
So if you eat more calories than you need, your body converts that extra energy into fat because it's a really efficient, compact way to store it for later. Makes sense.
Exactly. And fats come in different varieties based on their fatty acids.
Yep.
Saturated and unsaturated. Saturated fatty acids have straight hydrocarbon chains with only single carbon-carbon bonds. They're saturated with hydrogen atoms. Because the chains are straight, they can pack tightly together.
Which is why they're usually solid at room temp, like butter or lard, and often come from animals.
Right. Unsaturated fatty acids, on the other hand, contain one or more double bonds between carbons. These double bonds create bends or kinks in the chain.
Ah, so the kinks prevent them from packing tightly.
Precisely. Which makes them typically liquid at room temperature. Think olive oil or vegetable oil, and they usually come from plants.
Okay, saturated versus unsaturated. Got it. What other lipids are important? He mentioned phospholipids.
Yes, phospholipids are crucial. Dr. Hoffman points out their special, almost contradictory nature. They're amphipathic.
Amphipathic, meaning they have two different personalities towards water.
Kind of. They have a polar head, which contains a phosphate group, and this part loves water. It's hydrophilic. But they also have two nonpolar tails, which are the fatty acid chains, and these parts hate water. They're hydrophobic.
A split personality molecule. So why is that important?
It's biologically immense. Dr. Hoffman explicitly states that no cell would exist without phospholipids. Why? Because, quite remarkably, when you put these molecules in water, they spontaneously self-assemble. Their water-hating tails try to hide from the water, and their water-loving heads face outwards towards the water. This leads them to form the vital phospholipid bilayer, two layers with tails facing inwards, that constitutes the basic structure of all cell membranes.
Wow, so they just automatically create the boundary of the cell.
Pretty much. What's truly mind-blowing is how these molecules, just based on their chemical properties of loving and hating water, spontaneously arrange themselves to form the very boundaries of life itself. It's incredible self-organization.
Amazing. He also mentioned cholesterol briefly, didn't he? As another lipid.
Cholesterol. It's another important lipid, characterized by its distinctive four-ring structure. A lot of people hear cholesterol and immediately think bad, maybe because of heart disease links.
Yeah, it gets a bad rap sometimes.
But Dr. Hoffman explains its vital dual role. First, cholesterol is actually a key component of animal cell membranes. It wedges in between the phospholipids and helps regulate the membrane's fluidity and stability, keeps it from being too rigid or too floppy. And second, it's the necessary precursor molecule, the starting point, for all steroid hormones in your body. Think estrogen, testosterone, cortisol. All these powerful signaling molecules start out as cholesterol and are just slightly chemically modified from there.
So it's essential for membranes and hormones. Pretty important stuff.
Absolutely. Highlights how one molecule can have such diverse and profound impacts.
Okay, so we've done carbs and lipids. What about proteins, the third category?
Right, proteins. Dr. Hoffman describes proteins as incredibly complex and incredibly diverse, polymers built from smaller subunits called amino acids. He makes a fascinating point. There are only 20 common types of amino acids used by all known organisms on Earth, from bacteria to blue whales to you. This is seen as really strong evidence for a common ancestor, this shared biochemical toolkit.
Wow, only 20 building blocks for all that diversity, and they link together.
They link together via peptide bonds to form long chains called polypeptides. A protein can be one or more of these polypeptide chains folded up in a very specific way.
And that folding, that shape is really important, isn't it?
Absolutely critical. Dr. Hoffman elaborates on the four levels of protein structure, primary, secondary, tertiary, and quaternary. But the key takeaway he stresses is that a protein-specific, unique, three-dimensional shape, its conformation, determines its function. If that shape is wrong, even slightly, the protein probably won't work. Even a single misplaced atom can completely disable it, or worse, turn it into something harmful. Think about diseases caused by misfolded proteins. Shape, in the protein world, is truly everything.
Okay, shape equals function. And they come in different general shapes, too.
Yeah, Dr. Hoffman categorizes them broadly. There are fibrous proteins, which are typically long and strand-like, often providing structure. Think collagen in your skin or keratin in your hair, like ropes or cables. And then there are globular proteins, which are more compact, folded into intricate shapes. These tend to have more dynamic walls, things like transport, signaling, defense, and especially catalysis.
Catalysis. That brings us to enzymes, right?
Exactly. Enzymes are a critical type of globular protein that Dr. Hoffman emphasizes heavily. These are remarkable molecules that act as biological catalysts. What that means is they dramatically speed up vital chemical reactions within cells, often by thousands or even millions of times, without being used up in the process themselves.
So they make things happen way faster than they normally would.
Way faster. Without enzymes, the chemical reactions needed to sustain life-building molecules, breaking them down, releasing energy would happen far too slowly at body temperature. Life as we know it just wouldn't be possible. And because they aren't consumed, they can be used over and over again. They're like the cell's incredibly efficient workforce.
Wow. Okay, so it really raises the question, without enzymes, could complex life even exist?
It's hard to imagine how it could, really. They're that fundamental.
Okay, that covers proteins. One category left, nucleic acids, DNA and RNA stuff.
That's right. The fourth and final major category, nucleic acids, which include the famous DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid, and RNA, ribonucleic acid. Dr. Hoffman identifies these as polymers, just like proteins and polysaccharides, built from smaller subunits called nucleotides.
Okay, so nucleotides are the monomers for nucleic acids. What are they made of?
A nucleotide itself has three main parts bonded together. A 5-carbon sugar, it's deoxyribose in DNA, and ribose in RNA, that's the D and R in their names. A nitrogenous base. There are four main kinds for DNA, A, T, C, G, and four for RNA, A, U, C, G. And finally, a phosphate group.
Sugar, base, phosphate. Got it. And DNA has that famous shape.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Hoffman describes DNA's iconic double helix structure. It's essentially two long polynucleotide strands running in opposite directions, held together in the middle by specific hydrogen bonds between the bases. A always pairs with T and C always pairs with G. It looks like a twisted ladder.
And its job is basically information storage and transfer.
Primarily, yes. He notes its two key functions. Replication, which means that it can make exact copies of itself, allowing genetic information to be passed accurately from one generation of cells to the next. And transcription, where segments of the DNA code are used as a template to build RNA molecules, which then often go on to direct the building of proteins. It's the cell's master blueprint.
Okay, DNA and RNA store and use information. But Dr. Hoffman also talked about another really important nucleotide, didn't he? ATP.
Ah, yes, ATP, adenosine triphosphate. Dr. Hoffman singles this out as perhaps the most immediately crucial nucleotide for keeping cells running moment to moment. He uses a fantastic analogy describing ATP as the energy currency of the cell. It's like money. You don't usually trade your work directly for, say, groceries. You trade it for money, which you can then use universally for groceries, rent, anything.
So cells don't use energy directly from food. They convert it to ATP first.
Exactly. Your cells break down glucose and other fuels, capture the released energy, and store it temporarily in the chemical bonds of ATP molecules. ATP then becomes the readily spendable energy form that powers almost everything the cell does. It's the universal energy transfer molecule.
And here's where it truly hits home.
Mm-hmm.
This tiny molecule, ATP, powers literally every move you make, every thought you think. That's incredible.
It really is. Dr. Hoffman explains that the cell spends ATP through hydrolysis, breaking off the last phosphate group. That reaction releases a packet of useful energy. And this ATP energy then powers three main types of cellular work he identifies. Chemical work, which is driving energy-requiring uphill reactions like synthesizing polymers. Transport work, like actively pumping substances across cell membranes, maybe against their concentration gradient. And mechanical work, like the contraction of your muscle cells, making every physical movement possible, or the beating of cilia. It's the unseen engine driving virtually all cellular activity.
Wow. ATP, the energy currency. That's a powerful concept. And there you have it, a deep dive into the chemistry of you, as illuminated by Dr. Hoffman's brilliant lectures. From the inconceivably small atom to the grand, vital macromolecules, he really reveals this intricate, precise chemical ballet underlying all biological processes. It's truly incredible how understanding these fundamental chemical principles unveils the elegance and, well, the sheer interconnectedness of life itself.
Absolutely. If we connect this to the bigger picture, Dr. Hoffman's insights really show us that life isn't just some random collection of parts working independently. It's an incredibly finely tuned system built entirely on these fundamental chemical principles. Every function, every structure, every single breath you take is really a testament to the sophistication and, frankly, the efficiency of these molecular mechanisms that evolved over billions of years.
So maybe the next time you feel your muscles move, or you take a deep breath, or even just add salt to your food, take a second. Consider the astonishing atomic and molecular dance happening just beneath the surface. A dance we now know is meticulously choreographed by basic chemistry. What other everyday phenomena can you now see through a molecular lens armed with this new understanding? We hope this deep dive encourages you to keep asking questions, stay curious, and keep exploring the incredible world around you, and of course, within you.